Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, horror movies that get more relevant over time. Some movies just have more and more to say the older they get. It's very few, but the ones that do it are magic. And we're going to try to reverse engineer them a little bit and figure out how they're doing it. And talk about some movies that were relevant, that have become probably less so, and what they're missing. So to give one example to sort of explain what this concept is John Carpenter's 1988 masterpiece, They Live, was somewhat targeted at a very specific thing. It was partially born out of John Carpenter's frustration with Reagan's America and like the commercialization of politics and goods and culture. But it's just gotten more and more relevant as time has gone by. Forget its specific target. We live in an age where views and clicks are king. So it's a movie that anticipated that direction and has been surfing that wave and stays high up on the wave and never gets knocked off. Whereas George Romero's 1978 Dawn of the Dead, also a masterpiece, is still super relevant to horror fans because it's a great horror movie. But its take on consumer culture has gotten less relevant compared to They Live just by the accident of the death of malls. Since a lot of its take on how people get zombified by greed and just become creatures that want and want and want and don't think about anything else. They get dehumanized by their desires because the setting is in a mall. And those have become less and less popular over time. It kind of makes it not something that would pop right to mind when you ask what horror movies got relevant over time. I know this because when I asked the question on the Horror Weekly pages, the answers came back fast and furious, and I don't want to tell them all now because we're going to talk about them in a little bit, but They Live was one of the most remarked upon movies, and Dawn of the Dead literally was never mentioned once. Oh, and real quick, before we get deeper into this, because I'll forget, I wanted to mention, I had asked as a sort of challenge for people to give in iTunes reviews what their desert island music band would be. And got some great responses. So I want to shout out Terminator 86, who named the Desert Island bands as The Specials and The Clash. Great choices. And also Jeffrey Universe, who went with The Beatles and Radiohead. This challenge came from the Desert Island running motif in the movie Green Room. And I love that both of you refused to pick one single band, so you were absolutely following the pattern of my favorite character in that movie. Well done. Okay, and there's something interesting about this very question of whether horror movies get more relevant or not. One element of this is that if you ask a question like, what's the scariest horror movie, or what horror movies are scary or not scary? Pretty much every horror movie ever made can fit somewhere in that question, right? Like, Last Shift is scary. Hocus Pocus is not. I mean, I guess unless you see it at a very, very young age and something in there particularly freaks you out. And any horror movie you name, from 30 Days of Night to What We Do in the Shadows, can fit somewhere on the spectrum of scary or not. You can ask whether a horror movie is funny or not. And there's a spectrum there, too, that pretty much includes all horror movies, right? Like Scream, pretty funny. The Exorcist, really not funny, unless you're the devil. But with the question whether a horror movie is relevant or not, most horror movies don't even make sense to talk about in terms of that question. It's like you're playing poker and you've got a couple cards left to draw. And what matters is what cards your opponents have, what cards are in your hand, and the two cards that are left for you to get. Everything else in the deck isn't going to matter for this particular hand. And we're in the same position with the relevance of horror movies. Like, it doesn't make sense to ask whether Jason X is relevant. Like, the only way that conversation makes any sense is it relevant to the people who make horror movies, right? Like, should we set our next horror movie in space? Should the Babadook go to Mars for Babadook 2? I'm sure the kid from Babadook should go to Mars and never come back, but it's not relevant in terms of culture. Like, Jason X wasn't trying to say anything at all, so there's no way to discuss whether it's relevant or not. But it very much makes sense to ask whether King Kong is relevant, because King Kong was one of the first major movies to kind of think through the Jurassic Park principle, right? Like, if you push nature really hard, is nature going to revolt and push back? And that relevance thing is part of why we still are getting King Kong movies and we don't have a side universe of a bunch of Jason X sequels. It's also interesting because there were almost no responses compared to our usual volume when I did ask this question on the pages. And for the first time in all the podcast episodes we've done for Horror Weekly, literally nothing comes up when you Google this question. Like, when you search the phrase horror movies that get more relevant over time, no answers come up. We've done episodes on, like, what's the best standalone slasher movie? What's the best slasher movie that's not in an ongoing franchise? And when you search that term, you get a bunch of lists. You get a bunch of Reddit threads. We did an episode on what's the scariest horror movie scene of all time. And when you search that term, your computer breaks from the thousands of pages of results you get. But this question has no online answers of any significance that I can find, which might be a bad sign. Maybe I shouldn't have recorded this episode at all, because if it's such a hard question, maybe no one cares. But I do, so I'm just going to go ahead and do it anyway. So let's talk about the relevance recipe just for a second. I think it's important to get out of the way that one of the very first most important things a horror movie needs for relevance is it has to be fucking entertaining. Like, one of my favorite films is a 1926 Japanese silent film called A Page of Madness. It was partially written by one of my favorite writers, a guy named Yasunari Kawabata, who is the only Japanese author to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. But it's one of the greatest takes on, like, the gradual and then not so gradual combat with internal insanity. But it's not entertaining. I mean, it's only entertaining if this is something you're really, really in the mood for. It's a pretty deep cut, right? But, like, The Shining is also very much about this same subject and super entertaining. So much more relevant, because very few people have seen or even want to see A Page of Madness. And this tracks us back to John Carpenter's They Live, right? This movie has one of the greatest all-time cinematic takes on conformism, on subliminal messaging, but it's also got an almost six-minute alley fight, which is amazing. It's a movie that ran out of bubblegum and just came to kick our ass. So the number one thing for relevance, no matter how smart the message or how deep the movie is it's got to be fun, at least partially, right? But sticking with They Live for a second, another thing I think gives a movie a really good chance to grow more relevant over time is universalism, right? It's got to deal with something almost timeless. Like, one of the spooky things about They Live is that it was based on a 1963 short story called 8 o'clock in the Morning. So now you've got a movie rooted in its source material and themes of the early 60s that was an incredibly good take on late 80s society and is even more relevant now in the year 2023. And why is this? Well, one, everyone's trying to sell you something all the time. It's human nature and it's never going to change. It's only going to speed up as we see in the digital age. And number two, John Carpenter he loved the basics, right? He was a huge fan of Westerns, which are super minimal. You don't need much to make a Western. One of my favorite facts about all cinema is that some insane number of movies, like from the 40s and 50s, had quicksand in them. It was like 35% of all movies made in those decades had some appearance of quicksand. Why? It's like the easiest special effect they could do back then, like throw a hose in some sand and get it wet and then drop a character in it. It went away because, one, Mythbusters proved that quicksand doesn't really work. And two, special effects became amazing. So no one wanted to see anything that cheesy looking anymore. But John Carpenter loves that basic shit. Like, he loves minimalism in music. He loves just using shadows and lurking in the background to scare the hell out of you. And he's smart enough to know that some things are just always going to work forever. One of my very favorite things about They Live is how much time you just spend with Roddy Piper's character walking, just traveling and observing. And that is a thing that when it's a villain doing it, like the walking man, Randall Flagg in The Stand, is just super effective. When Cary Grant is walking around in North by Northwest, there's almost nothing on the screen, but it becomes him in a plane and one of the greatest images in all of movies. Like, War of the Worlds is also about aliens subjugating Earth, but it's not based on universal themes of relevance, right? Like, huge, giant, walking, killer alien robots are a lot less universal a theme than the people across from you at a bar may not be quite what they seem. So the images from War of the Worlds are cool, but the images from They Live inspired the artist Shepard Fairey, who founded Obey Clothing and created Obama's 2008 Hope poster for his campaign. They Live entered culture. Now, to be fair, maybe some of this is just a product of time. I mean, War of the Worlds was super relevant when Orson Welles scared the shit out of an entire nation with his Halloween broadcast of War of the Worlds alien invasion that sent Americans into the streets holding guns in panic, looking up into the skies. And now War of the Worlds isn't that relevant anymore. So who knows? Maybe They Live will not be super relevant 60 years from now. But as of right now, They Live is getting more and more relevant and War of the Worlds less. So what have we got in our recipe so far? It's got to be entertaining. It's got to be based on something universal or like a really minimal theme that's always effective. Or I guess not got to be, but like super helps. Now, the next one is, what if you have more than one great theme? So let's talk about Dracula and Frankenstein for a second. Most horror movies don't even manage to have one great theme, but Dracula and Frankenstein each have at least two. So in Dracula's case, you have sexual repression as a major theme, but you also have vampirism as a major theme. And the idea of something draining the life out of something else until it becomes no will of its own. Like, let's just do this for a second. If I say to you, there's something that comes into your life in insidious ways, more and more, demands more of your time, demands more of your attention, and slowly sucks the hope and the optimism and the energy out of you, what's the first thing that comes to mind? To me, it might be social media, but I'm describing Dracula as well, right? So you have something circa 1930, almost 100 years old, that when I described in a really stripped down way, sounds kind of like your phone. And in an era of increasing book banning and corporate boycotts, sexual repression seems like as relevant as ever. Frankenstein has the risks of playing God. And when you think about, like, was COVID created by a lab leak? It seems like Frankenstein could be written, like, tomorrow. I imagine Mary Shelley as a teenager living today on the outskirts somewhere around Palo Alto and Silicon Valley, reading an article about gene editing and writing the next great horror masterpiece of the mid-2020s. But Frankenstein also has the theme of rejection. The creature is rejected by his creator, and the creature is also rejected in Bride by his supposed mate, to which his reaction is the glorious, "We belong dead," which is the ultimate rejection of everything. I didn't ask for this, I didn't ask to be here, and I'm taking myself out. And guess what? I don't think you belong here either, I'm taking you with me. And I don't know about you all out there, but I feel like in my lifetime, this is the most alienated large groups of people have felt from each other that I can remember. So a horror movie based on the absolutely terrifying notion of complete rejection, completely being cut off. One of the great things about the Frankenstein novel is that Arctic kind of setting and that really, really chilling, no pun intended, ending with everything feeling so cold and so locked down. And it's kind of interesting to contrast these two movies, because if our recipe is coming out right, the fact that I think Dracula is ultimately more relevant and more influential than Frankenstein over time, even though they both contain equally important messages, simply comes down to the fact that Dracula is vampires and Frankenstein is medically assembled zombies, and vampires are more entertaining, right? Recipe ingredient number one. As I'm recording this, the news has just come out that Robert Eggers has wrapped the filming on his project Nosferatu, which is a remake of a movie from 1922, a silent one, in fact. So vampires carry on, and I know there will be other Frankenstein properties for sure, but there will certainly be more vampire movies released in 2024 than there will be medically assembled zombie movies. Vampires will always be slightly more relevant because, as Heath Ledger's Joker would say, they're just so much fun. The next ingredient in our recipe I'm going to call Catch the Right Wave. Let's take two movies by the same director, Videodrome and Crimes of the Future, both by the great David Cronenberg. Videodrome turned 40 years old this year. Crimes of the Future was made last year, so stands to reason that Crimes of the Future would be a lot more relevant to us now in our current situation than Videodrome, right? Wrong. It's not. Videodrome, oddly, is more relevant not only now than when it was made, but it's more relevant now than Crimes of the Future is. Now, if you're listening to this podcast 30 years in the future, first of all, hi. Second of all, in the future, maybe this, I sound like an idiot. Maybe this makes no sense because people are getting body modification surgeries six times a year, and it's the most talked about thing in the world. But because Videodrome focused on the manipulation of images and manipulating people through screens, through video and images, and the fact that screens are manipulating us basically every hour of every day of our lives in most cases, and the body modification part of Crimes of the Future, it has obviously a lot of meanings. David Cronenberg is a really sophisticated guy. But the surface meaning, the one that comes across first, is less relevant as of now. So to the future you, if you're listening to this and having a nice plastic sandwich, sure, that then this makes no sense. But as of right now, the 40-year-old movie is beating the 1-year-old movie in terms of relevance. And it's because Videodrome caught the right wave. Screens and images on screens became more and more omnipresent and manipulative. And that's part of what Videodrome was about. A lot of the 50s sci-fi horror movies were making the bet that if you, the people who made them, if they could time travel, you know, 70 years in the future and visit us in 2023, they would have thought we'd have whole cities or countries wiped out by huge atomic mutated insects or animals. Those are really fun movies, and a lot of them are great. I saw them on 35 millimeter in a theater recently, and it was a mind-blowing experience. But not in terms of relevance. This isn't a problem mostly that we have. Although I've been looking at a wasp that's floating around inside right now as I record this, and it's definitely bigger than it should be, but I don't think this is an atomic situation. The movie The Thing and the movie The Invasion of the Body Snatchers have very similar themes, but I think The Thing is the one that caught the right wave. So they both deal, in some major sense, with paranoia. And paranoia is catching the right wave in a broad way because it turns out that no matter what awful things happen, whether they're pandemics or they're like 9/11 terrorist strikes or they're major natural disasters, one byproduct of that is complete paranoia. After they happen, you're paranoid about getting on a plane. You're paranoid about when someone sneezes next to you. You're paranoid about being in a high-rise building that's about to fall over and The Rock's not going to come save you in a helicopter. But John Carpenter, who I think is showing himself in this episode to be a master of relevance, I think he caught the right wave better because he trapped the characters in a claustrophobic and stranded environment of paranoia, where Invasion of the Body Snatchers unleashed it across the world. It happened not just inside, but outside, in public spaces, in big groups. And it turns out, because of modern society, where we're inside more, isolated from each other more, because communism, which was a big element that fed into Invasion of the Body Snatchers, turned out not to be a major concern in our era, Invasion of the Body Snatchers caught a pretty good wave. It was a pretty good surf, but John Carpenter caught the best wave possible in the waters he was surfing in. Now, even though they're more horror adjacent than actual horror, movies like The Terminator or Ex Machina clearly are on the verge of having a pretty awful chance of relevance. I've been playing around a little bit with ChatGPT, and I think it's very possible that I could interview Vincent Price on this podcast in a future episode via artificial intelligence. And these prospects are pretty terrifying. I mean, let's be honest. Probably the four major technological revolutions of my lifetime are going to turn out to be personal computing, internet, mobile technology, and then AI. And it might be the most disruptive of the four. Another, I think, pretty surefire way to catch the right wave is just to embed a message in your horror movie about something that basically will always be. So, for example, the spaces that we live in, houses or work in, buildings or stay in, like on travels, like castles and huge spaces, are always going to have the potential to be creepy. Shirley Jackson's story of the lottery was much more relevant and influential when I was a kid than her novel The Haunting of Hill House was. But Haunting of Hill House has won, not only because it's possibly the greatest horror novel ever written, but also because that concept is never going away. A haunted space with character, like an Overlook Hotel, always works. As a matter of fact, you can just transfer it anywhere and it still works. The Nostromo in Alien, where they live in the time we spend with them on the movie, is terrifying. The movie Candyman, or movies, don't work nearly as well if they're not rooted in Cabrini Green. The movie 1408, which I think has become more and more interesting over time in general, really shouldn't work as well as it does, except for it has such a strong sense of place. So that's a new ingredient we're adding to the recipe. Catch the right wave. If you're making a bet on making a movie years ago, and you're deciding between the threat of out-of-control AI and the threat of gigantic mutated crickets, it's AI the way you should have gone if you were trying to achieve relevance. So now that we have our recipe of relevance, basically, let's try to score some movies with our tool and see if we can make some predictions, right? So Robert Eggers' The Witch, if we score that on our recipe, is it entertaining? I mean, to me, it's a 9 out of 10, but from running the Horror Weekly social media pages for years, I have to give it an honest grade of 5 out of 10, by which I mean if you randomly select 10 horror fans, probably 5 of them are going to enjoy it and 5 of them are not. Is it minimal or does it root itself in timeless themes? Fuck yeah, 11 out of 10. There are always going to be people who are not comfortable fitting into a larger part of a society. They're going to try to break away on their own, and they are going to realize that there are horrendous costs and maybe benefits if you can pull it off to going on your own. Plus, there's the whole patriarchy thing. There's the whole man versus nature thing. I mean, it's literally a cornucopia of minimal themes. It's also pretty minimalistic in how it was made and shot. I mean, there's no like cowboy hat shaped aliens screaming down through the sky in The Witch. The devil is a whispering voice from behind and a goat. No offense, Black Phillip. Don't come at me. I love you. Did it catch the right wave? I'm going to give it like a 7 out of 10 on this one because I'm not sure it was trying to catch a wave at all. I mean, the most obvious thing it's driving towards is the sense of evil or the power of evil. But that's a little broad for a wave. It's not as specific as paranoia or you created something you couldn't control, etc. So not the highest score, but pretty good. So will The Witch get more and more relevant over time? I don't suspect so. I don't think it has enough juice in our recipe to really make it noticeable on that front. Maybe influential on other filmmakers. Maybe beloved by horror fans in the future. But in terms of relevance, it's not going to be like a They Live or a Videodrome situation, I don't think. Now let's take Wes Craven's Scream. If we could go back in time and watch the movie in the 90s when it came out, before there were any sequels, and we had this relevance meter to apply to it, how would we have scored it for its future influence? Well, entertaining, 10 out of 10. I mean, it's almost a perfect horror movie of its kind. Wes Craven was one of the most talented horror directors of the modern age, obviously. Timeless themes or minimalism? Not really minimalistic, but timeless group of people against killer, spoiler, killers. Classic whodunit structure that goes back to basically the beginning of cinema. Yeah, let's give it like an 8 out of 10 on timelessness. Catch the right wave. Well, the primarily noticeable thing about Scream is its meta nature. I know the comedy thing is, but I don't really get that. I'm not a comedy or comedy and horror expert. Not legendary for my sense of humor. So let's just focus on the meta part. I mean, one of the world's biggest companies took a name that everyone recognized, Facebook, and rebranded themselves as Meta. Not that the metaverse is working out, but the meta trend is something that is definitely catching the right wave. Matter of fact, Wes Craven caught the wave so well, he like influenced the waves around his wave. And that meta nature, like, there's nothing quite like it. When you screw it up, it's bad. But when you hit it right, I remember that when Netflix first came on my radar with content, as with a lot of people, I imagine, was with House of Cards. When Frank just turns and starts talking to you directly like he's a Shakespeare villain, that, like, meta thing can give you goosebumps when it's done right. Obviously, it's overabused a lot now, so it's a lot harder to just like stand out and nail that. But still, when it's done right, it's amazing. So setting the main theme of your film as meta, I'm giving Wes 10 out of 10 on catching the right wave, right? So by our scale, we would have predicted that 2 months after Scream came out, that it would be a hugely influential movie. And to top it all off, it's a very flexible structure, right? Once you have the meta thing, it's sort of modular. You can drop anything you want in it. You can make it about meta, about toxic horror fandom. You can make it meta about the state of horror franchises. Let's run a bunch of Lovecraftian horror movies through our meter real quick. The Void, Dagon, Underwater, Annihilation. I give all these movies pretty high marks for entertainment, except for Annihilation, unless you're a particular kind of viewer. I give them low scores for minimalism, which makes sense because Lovecraft was a really complicated mythos. And I give them very low scores for catching the right wave because Lovecraftian or cosmic horror took a lot of hits with Lovecraft personally being a complete asshole, which is why the best Lovecraftian horror movies slice off part of what goes on in the cosmic horror space and deal specifically with that part, the way Event Horizon did by transposing it all into an environment where it was so different than what you'd expect, you don't even know it's Lovecraftian horror. Or the fantastic movie The Endless, which basically deals with the cold indifference of the universe as kind of like a villain, but grounds it in a very like real, almost like outdoor campgroundian sort of space, dealing with a part of what they can make work without trying to take on the whole legacy. But no matter how hard they try, they just score really low on the relevance scale. So I'm going to use our relevance scale that we've built together here and make a few predictions. Let's see how these look in 10 years. I've picked out three things that popped out of the scale when I ran them through just to see if it works. So even though it's not a movie, David Lynch's relaunch of Twin Peaks, The Return, I think blows the relevance scale out of the water. It's hugely entertaining, especially if you take it in pieces and you're not like killing yourself the whole time trying to figure out what's happening, which is absolutely not how David Lynch wants you to watch it. Even though it seems like it's completely crazy with tons of characters and so much going on, it's actually super minimal. I mean, Twin Peaks originally at its heart was a soap opera, essentially. So it's the building blocks of it are like unrequited love, hiding a murder, suburban insanity, etc. But the most important thing, the place where I score it 20 out of 10, is catching a wave. So let me explain this. The wave I think Twin Peaks The Return is maybe uniquely catching in a way that almost nothing else could is that everything feels like in entertainment it's heading towards we know everything in advance. Everything is pre-spoiled. Everything's pre-heard about. There's just no way to surprise us. I mean, the HBO show Succession just ended, and everyone was trying to guess what the outcome of this show would be. And there was like a TikTok video making the rounds the week before the show came out that completely called who was going to end up winning the fight to become the CEO of Waystar. And it had a very particular reason based on this character's name. I'm not going to spoil it in case you haven't seen it yet or care to, but completely called it. Now, there's some dispute about whether that was the actual reason the writers did it. But regardless, like, I watched that video before the show. It was very convincing. And I went into the show thinking, I bet X is going to be the CEO. And sure enough, X was the CEO, right? And I kind of knew almost all the other major plot beats or points that were going in. The execution was amazing. I loved the finale. But it wasn't a surprise, right? And that's kind of how almost everything goes now. It's very hard for me to walk into a theater and be completely taken aback by what I'm going to see. I know probably the people who did it, or I've heard these rumors, or I've seen too much in the trailers, et cetera, et cetera. And it's only going to get worse, is my point. And Twin Peaks The Return is impossible to spoil. It's impossible virtually to understand, except on an individual basis. And it's one of the only major cultural and media moments that a whole bunch of people shared and still have no idea what they shared. So it's almost catching the right trend, but in reverse. It's like bucking the trend in such a major way that it's against the Easter egg, like Easter eggification of major entertainment, right? The post credit scenes and all that crap. Like, is Twin Peaks The Return is so hostile to those things that it's going to stand out like the Everest of unexplainability compared to most other things that are going to get made. So I'm using the scale to predict that is going to become just more and more relevant over time. I'm also going to predict two movies that I really did not enjoy in the theater that have both grown on me in very peculiar ways, one way more than the other one. So the one that grew on me way more than when I first saw it is Jordan Peele's Us. So I think this movie is very entertaining. So I'm going to give it like an 8.5 out of 10 on the entertainment scale. On the minimalism timeless scale, I'm going to give it a high score too. Let's say 8 out of 10. I mean, it's a very small cast. It's very manageable settings and situations. It really widens out to a huge scope at the end, but that's like all of a sudden and all kind of at the end. And just the ideas of like mirrors and carnivals and the things that are happening in the movie, vacation houses, there nothing here is like something that couldn't be told in a story 200 years ago. But again, the place this movie pops for me on the relevant scale is the Catch the Right Wave, because what a clever bet Peele made with this one. What trend? What wave is he catching? Us. He made the movie about you. He made the movie about us. There's nothing human beings like to talk about more than themselves. There is no way to place a surer bet on a trend than to make the focus of attention of the entire movie on you. This is like getting insider trading knowledge on a stock in advance. It's a genius move. And I kind of hated this movie in the theater. I saw it with a really good friend and we argued about it for like hours afterwards. We didn't even, and we both, it's funny, we were arguing at the movie. We both agreed in our initial reaction to it. It has since really grown on me in peculiar ways. I still have huge problems with some plot holes, But it's like spookily memorable. I find visuals from it and sounds from it and ideas from it popping into my head and weird moments. It just it grew on me a lot. But regardless, impartially, just on the scale, I think it places the best, highest odds possible bet on trend, maybe, that you could possibly do in a movie, and does it in a really sneaky way where you don't really notice that's what's happening at first. But this movie is a biography of you, the viewer. So definitely think this one's going to grow in relevance over time. And then the last prediction I'll make from the scale, and I think the movie that's going to gain most in relevance over time, out of all the ones I could think of by using this new thing we've constructed, is the movie Midsommar, Ari Aster's movie. Now, there's some caveats here. It's very possible that Ari Aster is going to flame out as a director and drive audiences away in like a pretty hostile way, kind of like a Lars von Trier situation a little bit. But the thing about Midsommar is it's decently entertaining, right? I wouldn't have scored it that highly on it. It's visually stunning and it's got great acting and it's got things that happen in it that there's just no way you could predict or expect. So it's decent on the entertainment scale. And if you're the kind of, your nature is to enjoy movies that are like that, it's probably a 10 out of 10 in the entertainment to you. But like, in all honesty, if I did the thing we talked about earlier of, if I just randomly took 10 horror fans and they watched Midsommar, I have a feeling 7.5 of them would be entertained. So there's that. Now, the minimalism side, the timeless themes side, I think it's good, right? Like it's a movie you could imagine being filmed in 1940s. Story-wise, anyway. But the catch the right wave meter, again, is spiking. Maybe I broke it with Twin Peaks The Return and Us. Like, maybe the needle is just faking me out because it looks so high on the scale on this one. But this theme to me is that there is no winning with people, right? Like, your significant other is going to drive you crazy. The people you try to join are going to drive you crazy. The community you came from is going to drive you crazy. Your small band of friends is going to drive you crazy. The new community you try to join is not only going to drive you crazy, they are crazy. Like, people are inescapable and they're going to aggravate you and incite you and make you feel like you're losing it. And in whatever the post-social media era that we're sort of moving into is, that vibe that the movie gives with like very small, quiet moments where you try to steal away and just get the fuck away and just try to like stand in a field and like have a thought to yourself without interruption, and then it all coming crashing down in a big shit show of intrusion from other people or having to figure out how to solve other people's problems or et cetera. That feels like the best possible trend besides maybe AI to pick to be relevant over the next like 2 decades or so. So I fully expect Midsommar to grow in stature way above something like Hereditary or et cetera, or even like the one-off lucky ones like Train to Busan, which, you know, has some really cool like family responsibility messages in it. But like, there's a transportation horror element where transportation with self-driving cars and like everything that's coming, it's going to get strangely probably safer overall statistically, but way more horrifying when the things go wrong. Like when an algorithm brings down a plane or like your Tesla self-immolates with you in it. Like, those things are going to really stand out, right? So transportation horror is going to be relevant, but that's like a small slice of the pie chart, right? Like Midsommar, I think, is going to hit the sweet spot of what it takes to be a relevant horror movie up through, say, 2050. Okay, so let us know what you think at Horror Weekly on Facebook or Horror Weekly Pod on Instagram. I have a fearful suspicion that this will be the least relevant podcast episode we've done in a while, because it's very dense, right? For which I apologize, I guess, but, you know, we got to follow where inspiration goes. If you do, strangely, somehow by some miracle, enjoy this or what we're trying to do, you can let us know with ratings on Spotify and iTunes or just feedback. I got some amazing messages in the last couple weeks via the Horror Weekly Facebook page itself of encouragement, which I completely appreciate. We're like 2/3 of the way to our goal of ratings on Spotify. We were aiming for 50. We're at like high 30s. So thank you so much to everyone who's done that. Keep the feedback coming. We love it. And until next Wednesday, have a great and relevant to you Horror Week.